Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Think you know the Brooks Ghost? Think again. Introducing the all-new, better-than-ever Ghost 16. Now with nitrogen-infused cushioning for lightweight, supreme softness that feels good every step, every street, every single day. So go ahead, take your daily joyride in the all-new nitrogen-infused Ghost 16. It'll turn your everyday miles into everyday endorphins. Let's run there. Head to brooksrunning.com to learn more.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
I had to go about it, write it out, and find it myself. And there's some stories I can tell you.
This is the Final Word Cricket Podcast with Adam Collins and Vidushan Ahantaraja, guest hosting today from my backyard in North London. Brought to you by the good people at Avance Hair Studios, the world leaders in hair restoration. We have plenty to get through today on the show. A stunning quadruple century in the county championship. Ravi Shastri's frightening blueprint for Test cricket. The Commonwealth Games are coming this week. A gem of a nerd pledge, which takes us through to the second Test match between Sri Lanka and Pakistan at Gaul. A scathing report into racism inside Scottish cricket. But first, as I say, we've got back on the show to co-host this week. He's spent a week on the road covering the England men's white ball team, which must mean you're back covering cricket full time. ESPN Crick Info's new senior correspondent. Hello, Vish.
Hello, Carlo. It's nice to be back in this garden. I think usually we've got less of our wits about us.
Yes.
When we've been in here, which is good. Using the barbecue as a bit of a stand as well for a camera. Massive fan of that. Back doing full time. Really enjoying it. Reminding myself that the last when I left cricket full time, which was about, I want to say, maybe about 2019 ODIs were on the up, and I came back, and I think it's time to get rid of them.
Yeah, that's right, isn't it? I mean, it's kind of like after what happened last week, we spoke with Matt Rowler, your colleague from Crick Info, about the Ben Stokes retirement, and we were sort of noting that, gee, one day cricket's really fallen off the agenda day to day, so much so that we didn't even mention Rishabh Pant's 100 last week. You know what I mean?
Like, right, yeah,
it just
isn't
dominating and eating up the conversation. And that series that you've been covering between England and the Proteas, I mean, the first match was played in 40-degree heat, or near enough, in Durham. The second match was a 29-over affair, and the third match was rained out. I mean, it was a bad week for a bad week, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, it was the kind of ODI equivalent of, you know, putting a spider in a jar full of ants. It's like, you don't really learn anything. You kind of leave thinking that there's no way of deciphering any of it, really, because even, you know, I was writing a review today for Crick Info about, like, what Josh Butler would have learned from the ODI series and just the ODIs in general, because that's now done. ODIs are done for the summer now.
Yeah, yeah.
We're not even in August.
After all that complaining about there's too many one-day internationals,
exactly.
That's it for months.
Yeah, that is it, yeah. And, not just that, but, the 25-over dash, the fact that it was rained off, there was... Maybe from Josh Butler's point of view and from an English fan's point of view, it's a little bit worrying because you leave it with no real conclusions. And I say that as someone who had to pull a few out of my backside last night. But very, very strange. And, you know, to have an ODI series that, you know, in terms of the South Africa series that started with a full squad and was eventually, you know, I was writing a preview for what the 11 might be on Sunday, and it was the easiest one I've ever done because there was no one else to pick.
Yeah.
you know, one of them had retired, one of them had had heat stroke, you know, Matt Potts on that first ODI, and it just seemed a bit of a mess.
Yeah, so Matty Potts only got through four overs in his one-day international debut last week. South Africa capitulated in the second, you know, the 29-over dash, so you can't really... but still, you think with these players having so much short-form experience, they wouldn't go so poorly in a setting like that, on a good pitch too. And then, yeah, leads. I suppose the only positive for South Africa is that big Rassie van der Dussen, he's averaging 75 in one-day cricket now. He's, I think, number three in the world, according to the ICC. But, yeah, building around him is going to be tough.
Yeah, you say that, but I was thinking about it the other day, and maybe it's because we haven't seen enough cricket that, you know, the theories that we go into a series with are still quite prominent, even, you know, a week, 2 weeks in. But you look at that team, Quinton de Kock, you know, arguably not quite in the form of his life, because he's had a pretty good life in terms of white ball cricket, but he's hitting them well, you know, was on his way to getting 100 before the rains came. You've got him, you've got Rassie, you've got Markram, who is basically there or thereabouts. You've got David Miller, who seems very comfortable down at six. And you know, Rassie is the lead man at the moment, but it feels like all the component parts are there.
And yet, for all of that, they'll be playing in the World Cup qualifier next year rather than automatically qualifying, which speaks to their diminishing fortunes in one-day cricket over the last 3 years, not just in this series. But probably that's enough on that. We have to move straight on because, really, I mean, that's it, isn't it? I mean, despite being the high-profile series in the middle of summer, you know, a generation ago, the one-day is against South Africa, you know, middle of July would have generated so much activity. We've done 2 minutes. I'm like, well, that's probably enough.
Yeah, but do you know the great thing about the ODIs, especially when they came before the test, was this idea that, like, not only would you get a first sight, it would be a bit, you know, it's like the early rounds of a boxing match.
Yep.
It's a bit more of feeling each other out until you get into the sixth round, which is essentially the tests. But also, like, we love a bit of drama, and that's where the niggle starts. You know, people start having these little agendas. So, for example, Klaassen with the side screen in the second ODI, it was almost like there's, you know, Roy Keane, former Manchester United and Republic of Ireland footballer, turned basically, you know, wind-up merchant pundit who's always up for a fight.
Yeah.
He says, you know, sometimes when you're having a bad game, smash into someone just to feel something. And it felt like this ODI series needed, actually, just have a go at him.
Sounds like your mate Dermot Burton, who we played with a couple of years ago. That was always his philosophy. If things weren't going well, start a fight.
But there was an element of that. Like, even, you know, I know people don't have a particularly fond view of the press, but we were in the press conference and suddenly, like, this could come alive. Should we poke them? And, you know, David Willey, punchy guy. Klaassen, quite charismatic, punchy guy. And we're like, oh, yeah, there's something here. And then ODI rained off.
Probably the biggest talking point out of the series was when it did rain, and Sky had that really interesting panel with their commentators and pundits around the future of cricket, not just about one-day cricket, but the game more broadly. And Ravi Shastri, who's here as a commentator, I mentioned off the top, it was a pretty scary blueprint piece to camera and remembering that he's just finished as the coach of the Indian national team for 4 years. It's not as though this guy is that well that far removed from the BCCI. Like, when he speaks, you can reasonably interpret it as being at least informed by what he's hearing at the top of the BCCI.
It was scary because it was structured.
Yes.
He was reading. He's like, we've had this on boards for a while, you know. I know. It's like you walk into a favourite coffee shop and you know exactly what you're getting.
Yeah, right. So, look, his takeout quote is, you can't have 12 teams or 10 teams playing test cricket. You've got to keep the top six, keep the quality and respect quality over quantity. That's the only way you can open a window for cricket to be played. Expand teams in one-day cricket and T20 cricket if you want the game to spread. But test cricket will have to reduce the number of teams that play. And he goes on to describe the comparison to football with the Premier League, La Liga, German League, South American, Copa America, all the rest of it. Talks about the World Cups. But what it boils down to is, and he sort of tempered this at the end by noting that other teams can play outside of what he describes as the top six, but they'll need to qualify for test cricket.
Yeah, right.
I mean, this is exactly at the time when we've had two teams added to the schedule in 2018-19 in Ireland and Afghanistan. Great stories both. We've got the World Test Championship providing some structure at long last to the bilateral series that are played across a two-year stretch, and now it feels as though we could be heading in the other direction, and comments like that only sort of sharpen up that view.
Yeah, like, he said the quiet part out loud. We'd always suspected that this was going on in the background. And the thing I would say, it is, you know, the decision will ultimately come down to what the BCCI want to do. But there are other member nations who've contributed to this, namely, you know, the ECB and Cricket Australia.
Yeah.
Because those conversations, you know, the BCCI aren't having those conversations on their own. I think that's one of the things that it's quite easy to have one, you know, big bad wolf, but really there were three. And for all the manner in which the ECB may have, you know, like, we can talk about the 100 in a different way, but in terms of like how that came through, that was with a view to being like, right, we need a tighter schedule primarily, but we also need a schedule that's going to make us a lot of money. And from the BCCI's point of view, when you look at Test cricket, it is the moneymaker when they play two teams, England and Australia. And similarly, when England play those two teams and Australia play those two teams. And I think, in terms of like going back to what I said before about saying the quiet part out loud, right now in the UK, there is a Mumbai Indians team touring and playing second 11 games. Mm. And one of the players in that Mumbai Indians team is Dewald Brevis,
yep,
who is, you know, the next big thing. South Africa's next big thing. The next AB de Villiers. And he is basically having a pre-season with his IPL team. Now, whether or not that is conducive to a greater evil down the line, we don't really know. But whatever it is happening slowly but surely. So when Shastri was talking about the leagues, he was talking about a T20 league. He was talking about a nine-month IPL. And there's an element of... One of the things in, like, to speak exclusively about English cricket, one of the things that when you speak to agents, one of the things they implore on their players who are thinking about going white ball only is don't piss off your county. Because what your county gives you is a base for 9 months, training, physio, coaching, whenever you want it, without necessarily having to apply all that to your county. And when you look at a team like Rajasthan Royals in the way they've tried to do things and replicate the success the Mumbai Indians have, they've basically tried to do that. There's a reason they signed a lot of English players. There's a reason they have all these kind of schemes where they, you know, work with local communities and things like that. There is an element of, you know, sports washing is too harsh a term, but there is an element of PR that goes through everything like that. And when you speak to people at Rajasthan, they're pretty open about that, I'd say. They're pretty open about the fact that, you know, we don't just want to be a three-month team. We want to be a year-round team. And I don't know, like, you tell me, but if this feels like an offshoot of it, even beyond going to the fact that, look at the private equity that they're buying up in other leagues like the CPL.
Yeah, and of course last week in South Africa, where that's probably the most prominent example. We went through it in the weekly show last week that, you know, there'll be the IPL and then there'll be the mini IPL, which will be what takes place in South Africa. And that'll, you know, I don't want to reduce it, but it'll be tantamount to that, won't it? Because it'll just give the chance for the clubs to effectively have a second season.
So I wanted to ask you about this. I thought about you straight away when the South Africa thing came through, because it kind of broadly reminded me of a conversation we had. I say a conversation, I played no part in it because I have no expertise in this. But you were talking about the difference between the AFL and the VFL back in the day and all these different leagues going on and how they eventually, they were supposed to be together and then they broke apart. Do you think that's, down the line, this is where we are, where we have actually just almost like the PGA and European Tour, you have two independent tours?
Yeah, it could be more the latter, where you have sort of the LIV Golf, dare I say it. Yeah. I know this won't be quite the same with the Saudi investment in LIV Golf, but...
Well, give it a minute.
Give it a minute, yeah, sure. But I can see where you're taking it. And you know, what I found most egregious in the commentary was the suggestion that that these teams that weren't of the top six, so to speak, made for a bad investment for Test cricket. Like, there's some exclusivity window for the big three, and like, they'll always be good enough. But, you know, I made the point that England weren't in the top six still a couple of minutes ago.
Yeah.
The last time Australia were in Bangladesh and England were in Bangladesh, they won a Test match. Bangladesh knocked off the World Test champions in January this year at home. New Zealand, who are routinely outside the top six, won that World Test Championship last year against the behemoth of India. Like, the gap between the best and the worst isn't as clear-cut as it's depicted in that commentary. It's not as though we've got, sort of, to stick with football, Premier League clubs picking on teams in the non-league here. Like, you know, and it's never been that way. And even in India's rise, they didn't become one of the most dominant players in global Test cricket overnight. It took them decades to get to where they were as strong as they are around the world now. And it's taken what we celebrated, their investment in short-form cricket, as Harsha Bhogale describes it, going into every corner of every village in India and scouring for talent and developing talent. They should be applauded for that. You know, we should embrace what the IPL has given the game in terms of the talent we get to see from the Indian national team and beyond. But where it can compromise and maybe even eliminate a number of test playing nations, that's just straight up scary stuff. And the other part about television networks not enjoying uncompetitive test series, I mean, yeah, that's true. But as Andrew Nixon points out, you know, you want to look at a 50 over World Cup, where are the uncompetitive games often played? Between full member nations, where one team thumps the other. That's just cricket, unfortunately. You've got to put the yards in and watch the rubbish games in order to get the payoff and the yield of the thriller from the final ball.
If you want the sunshine, you've got to put up with the rain.
Well, I think I'm thinking something you wrote on World Cup final night back in 2019, you know, that idea that you tell people
who
aren't cricket people, you tell them, no, I promise it can be this good. You just got to go on the journey.
And
so it is for Test cricket, which is probably right now the most competitive format, by the way. I mean, Test cricket in the last 12 to 18 months has been exhilarating. And to think that this is the time when people are having that sort of existential crisis around its longevity for teams who, yeah, they don't make money when they play it at home. But let's talk about how we can spread the pie more evenly to ensure that when New Zealand play a Test series at home, that they make a buck or two. That should be where we're orienting the conversation, not talking about just kind of scrapping teams carte blanche.
The silver lining, I thought, from the Shastri comments was the fact that it is out in the open. As you say, when he talks, people listen.
Yeah.
And it's, I think back to the start of the 2020 COVID summer when Ebony Rainford-Brent and Michael Holding, you know, took the platform and owned that platform in terms of talking about institutional racism within English cricket and more broadly within cricket in general in Holding's case. And I remember thinking, if it wasn't raining that first morning, we wouldn't have had that segment.
Yeah, that was going to be at lunch, wasn't it? And
yeah,
it would never have had that that sort of front of house happy accent, but what a beautiful one.
Yeah, and I thought, well, actually, this is, you know, kind of on the other side of the spectrum with that, whereby it's, oh, so now we know.
Yeah.
He was so articulate. Yeah. It was so forthright and it was so structured that you're like, okay, this is happening and we're talking about it and other people are talking about it. And it was filled newspaper columns and we're just a bit more aware of it now. And I know kind of, what does that mean? What does that mean writing or, you know, trying to talk to the ICC, trying to hold the ICC to account? We know that they're not really the institution to go after because they're not really an institution.
Well, they're a federation.
Yeah.
And we've made this point on the podcast before. All they are is a collective of representatives from the full member nations.
Exactly, yeah.
Which means that when you've got so much power vested in the hands of so few, principally the big three, it'll be I mean, even the fact that it's been celebrated widely. I was talking to a senior member of CA recently about the schedule and the fact that there are going to be so many more test matches across the cycle between Australia, England and India. And I kind of get it. From a self-interested perspective, there will be more money made and thus more money in the game, and that's a great thing. But it doesn't have to be at the expense of other cricket played outside of just India and England from an Australian perspective.
Yeah, I mean, we're just it's not just cricket, it's football as well at the moment, whereby COVID gave us a chance to reset and we thought, actually, we can come out of this in a better place, you know, a bit more equitable as a sport on a number of fronts, and it just doesn't play out like that.
Yeah, it just provides an opportunity for the thiefdom, if you like, to gather their thoughts and regroup, something like that. Let's go to a positive story. Sam Northeast, 410 not out for Glamorgan between Friday and Saturday. He faced 450 deliveries, 45 fours, 3 sixes, a beautiful set of numbers. He hit a six to move from 396 to 400. The first quadruple ton in the championship since Lara in 1994. He's just the third quadruple century this century in the 2020s, after Lara made 401, 400. I'm forgetting my Lara scores here. 400 against England and 501 for Warwickshire. Yeah. The third highest county championship score of all time behind celebrity racers Archie McLaren and Brian Lara. The 11th highest score of all time. The ninth man to get a quadruple ton. Sorry, not the 11th highest score of all time, but the 11th quadruple ton. His average went from 38.9 to 40.2 in one hit. And when you consider it was the 325th first-class innings, that's a massive sample size. Mm-hmm. They could have cracked on for the all-time six-wicket record. They decided to declare at lunch. In the end, lucky they didn't go on with it because Glamorgan, who were in third before the start of play, moved to second with a full points victory. They won with five overs to spare. They timed their declaration perfectly, so credit to David Lloyd for that and to the batters in question who were happy to pull the pin because Cook, of course, was on 191 down the other end. So a perfect conclusion to the tale. And Vish, you've worked with Sam for years on your podcast, Two Hacks and One Pro. Nice guys finishing first.
Yeah, absolutely. And someone who has professionally been through the ringer in the last couple of years. Bear in mind that, so we started this podcast with him, myself, Will McPherson of the Evening Standard, and Sam when he was a Hampshire player. And it was a product of COVID, really.
Yeah.
It was, you know, we'd interviewed him a couple of times on a previous iteration of that podcast and got on really well with him and thought, you know, he was looking to do something in that space. And, you know, I kind of came on to help him. We decided, actually, why not? Three of us, why don't we just get in a room and talk shop about the game? Maybe 2 weeks later, England announced a 55-man COVID squad.
That's right, yeah.
And he wasn't in it.
It was more noticeable for the guys that weren't in it, wasn't
exactly,
it?
Exactly, yeah.
Tom Abel wasn't there. And Sam Miltice was the other big name.
And it was a mix of red and white ball players. Yep. And the reason it was so big was because they were all bubbling at the Aegeus Bowl and they needed enough players to play practice games in various different formats because you couldn't bring net bowlers in as well or fill-in players like that. But it was... You know, you'd have had the, you know, Glenn Maxwell has been a, you know, fan of the show, he's been on the podcast a number of times. He will, I'm sure, have told you the number of times you get lied to as a professional player, whether it's by a selector or by a coach, someone saying, just keep doing what you're doing, you're banging on the door, we're talking about you, you know, you're so close. And Sam had that for the longest time. You know, he was an under-19 captain, he was kind of to the manor born, he was going to be this England player. At least that's what people told him. And then, you know, gets into his 30s and you couldn't have a clearer sign that you were nowhere near. And it definitely jolted him. It got him thinking about, God, have I wasted these years of my career just thinking, could I have done more? Could I have batted in different positions? You know, all the things that batters contend with, he was suddenly, you know, left to his own thoughts to wonder if it was all for nothing.
And it sends him on this odyssey. So remembering that he starts at Kent, he's made captain after Rob Key retires. He's pretty young, I reckon, when he's made captain in 2015, 2016.
Yeah.
Leaving that gig, hugely controversial call from him to leave his home county. Goes to Hampshire, which is considered to be the place you go for a bit of coin. Whether it's accurate or not, neither here nor there. But the perception is, want a bit of extra dosh, go to Hampshire.
You're not going for the nightlife.
You're not going for the nightlife, that's for sure. We tried. and then, yeah, last year gets loaned out a couple of times, finds his way to a Division II county. And I must admit, I probably thought he's setting himself up for the long term to be the big dog at a, and I hate this term, but smaller county compared to those that he played at, especially Hampshire, in the second division. But instead, in the space of, well, half a season, two-thirds of a season, but especially over the weekend, his name goes back in up in lights again. I mean, perfect timing for it, considering, you know, England have a very busy winter schedule.
Yeah, so it'd be interesting to see. So we were, like, see kind of how this plays out from here, because we were at, in Manchester for the second ODI when he was going to, I can't remember what he was overnight, but when he basically went past 200, went past 300, and Rob Key was on hand and he kind of arrived midway through. And I was sat next to Will and he comes over to us and he was like, have you seen what Sam's doing? And obviously him and Sam go way back. When Sam was, when Sam had left Kent and there was a bit of, you know, in very contentious circumstances, he was training with Rob Key. Rob Key was calling him up and chatting to him and helping him kind of get through to the next step and just kind of discussing what the next step would be. And, you know, he clearly has a lot of affection for him and, you know, he had the stream up and he was watching it. And, yeah, it'd be interesting, you know, in one way he won't have a better advocate than Rob Key. In another way, you know, we know how these things work. Sometimes your bias goes the other way because you don't want to be seen biased. So
I suppose this helps, though, doesn't it? Had he made a double, bearing in mind he'd never made 200 in any form of cricket. His highest score in any cricket was 191 before Friday.
There's a brilliant quote in there, isn't there, where he said he was more nervous in the 190s and then gets to his 100 with a 6 in the 390s. And he was like, and he says, what was I playing at? Why was that so much easier?
The way I read that was that they were declaring at lunch, and it was, I think it was We Are Mulder bowling, wasn't it? And they were trying to drag the clock out, and he might have had 3 balls left. And he's like, well, it's in my arc. I'll have a dash at this, and pops it over long.
Oh, sure, but I think he was, you know, stepping back and looking at it. He was like, what kind of cavalier?
Well, it certainly was a great punctuation mark. But yeah, the fact that he now, I mean, even in Australia, listening to a couple of interviews overnight, Adam White had him on his program, on his breakfast show. Jared Waitley was talking about him on SEN with Robert Craddock in the morning. Accomplished cricket broadcasters that they are, they wouldn't know an awful lot about Sam because he hasn't been on the international stage before. If he now gets picked for an England squad, well, he'll always be known for this, right? He overtakes Graham Hick for what happened back in 1988 when he made that 405 at Taunton. I said, you know, one of only 4 quadruple tons in the history of the county championship. It means now that he has the opportunity to almost restart at age 33, which is bizarre to say, given all of that history that we've gone through. But he does get a reset button here.
So I was talking to a former pro a couple of weeks ago who didn't play for England. And he said one of the worst things you can have as a, even when you're still active in your later years, is overhearing or reading or even seeing a tweet or something like, whatever happened to so-and-so?
Yeah, you absolutely.
Know, it's that wondering of, oh, yeah, he was a good player, wasn't he?
That horrible line of the best player never to play for England?
Yeah, no one wants that.
I mean, you know, and obviously over the years you hear players like that. I remember when I was growing up, it was like, oh, Jamie Siddons only played one day for Australia.
And Glenn Chappell over here.
You know, there have been players that have carried that tag around them. And Glenn Chappell did play once, of course, but, you know, not more than once.
Yeah.
And, you know, that pain of being so dominant. He was probably trending that way. Who knows? Maybe that's what his career will be. This will be the shining glory, and he'll never get the chance to take the next step. But yeah, I like the idea of him being renewed and reborn by this.
Yeah, yeah. So I suppose, yeah, the most recent player from an English perspective is James Hildreth.
Oh, of course, yeah.
Yeah.
At least he's not going to grow his hair long like James Hildreth.
I think
sort of a cry for help,
actually,
that.
Yeah.
It might.
Are you suggesting James Hildreth's run of form at the end of his career was, you know, running parallel to a midlife crisis?
Well, you've said it. I'm just reflecting on the sort of wispy grey hair that he's got going on there.
So the... yeah, like it'd be interesting to see where he kind of goes from here, because it's nice that he's had a few different iterations, as I mentioned before, like the under-19 captain who actually started quite slowly, then the run churner who was, you know, 100 after 100 after 100, and when there's a hashtag made about you, the only successful hashtag in the last 10, 15 years has been Nisa Must Play.
Nisa Must Play.
Yeah. And also, to be fair, when you brought up this Glamorgan game, I thought it was going to be a Nisa story.
Well,
because he
bowl him to victory,
yeah,
didn't he?
Yeah, he did.
He still keeps chipping away doing his thing. And that's the other point of this, right? The brilliant declaration. I touched on it before.
Yeah,
but probably the easy thing to do there as captain is going, oh, you know what? I can't deprive him a chance of breaking Lara's record. I can't deny Cook the chance of posting a double century. They've batted so well. Break the all-time six-wicket record. I'll give them an hour. I'll give them 45 minutes.
Yeah.
I'll have to bet him. But had he given them 45 minutes, Glamorgan are still in third. Now, they're in a provisional promotion position.
Even from a game situation point of view, when the team batting first scores over 550.
Well, it's never happened, right?
Yeah.
That's the highest score in a first innings, 568, where a team's lost outright.
Yeah, so if you've got basically 1,200 runs between you in two first innings,
yeah,
and you're into the fourth day, you're probably going to think, right, it's just flat. How are we going to take all
yeah,
those wickets?
Yeah.
In many ways, it was a fine declaration. And I think, you know, you touched on it before when you referred to Glamorgan as a smaller county. I think Glamorgan have always struggled with the perception that they're just in it for the money, because they have a test match venue.
Yep.
They get given tests. There was, you know, when Durham were relegated and had, you know, high-profile games taken off them, some of them were given to Glamorgan, and some Durham fans rightly pointed to Glamorgan and said, but what are they doing for the game? Look at the number of England players we produce. What are they doing? They're just kind of T20s. They don't even sell out, you know, their stadium slap bang in the middle of Cardiff, despite its, yeah, the location and the fact that the T20 Blast does do very well in that region as well. That region, I mean, kind of like, you know, Somerset, the west of the country. But there's an element of, like, ruthlessness to them now. And, you know, it's not just...
And they won a trophy last year as
exactly,
well.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah, the Royal Under Cup. And it's not a case that, like, Sam's brought it to them, but they've been slowly building towards this, building with, you know, some local Welsh players backed up with some kind of hardened professionals. And if they do go up, they've absolutely earned it, because it's, you could argue on all three fronts, they're massively improved.
Glamorgan, watch this space. Sam, Northeast, North Beast. Talking about your hashtag, watch this space as well.
I thought, Matt Roller made the point that when Chris Gayle, you know, Chris Gayle, known as a T20 gun at the moment,
yep,
the number on his back, 333, highest test score. Sam Northeast, you know, should get, what did he finish on again? 410. So he'd get 410 on his back. And then
imagine he finished on 420. that would have been even better. Imagine the cross-promotion opportunities.
Well, after the Gayle, you know, Gayle calls himself the Universe Boss, I'm going to start calling Sam Northeast Universe Toff. So.
Do it. We can make this happen. Before we get into the break in the middle of the show, we have a lot of cricket to get through in the second half. Did you catch the press release that went out from New Zealand cricket during the week, Fish?
I didn't, because I was too distracted by Ian Botham's Twitter feed again.
Wow. I mean, they're all in. I hope, I'm not the first person to observe that. I hope that What Are You Thinking Kiss Kiss doesn't get NFT'd for Botham when he got the old boy out. From a New Zealand...
It'll be pixelated because they'll, you know, because it's clip art in it. So.
I suppose, yeah. With New Zealand, yeah, sort of nice guys of cricket tag. It's worth noting they did have a relationship with Dream 11 before. Now, Dream 11 is sort of thin edge of the wedge when it comes to gaming advertising. We've gone into that before. We don't need to cover old ground. But Yeah, New Zealand choosing to go into the metaverse, so to speak. Their press release, we could do an entire segment reading it out, as Jeff has before. Jeff enjoys reading out the sort of press releases full of jargon, and we'll withhold the urge of doing that right now. But yeah, just the language used there. I get that it's easy money, but I mean, there are a lot of ways to earn, and I'm not saying that that it's easy for New Zealand to bring in cash, but this just feels gross.
Well, it's linked to a conversation we had at the top of the show about, you know, the way that the top three test teams are, you know, have this little cabal where they don't really play anyone else.
Yep.
And New Zealand have been the team that suffer from that.
Yep.
And it's weird to say that of the World Test Champions, but that's just the truth of the matter. Like, they have for so long been seen as something of a inconvenience, and it always seemed that the pull to playing New Zealand was going to New Zealand, like spending a bit of time in New Zealand.
Sure. Yeah, it's a nice place to go.
Having a warm-up, you know, a warm-up week in Queenstown. It's
sure.
always of that ilk, isn't it? And or you know, they're a great warm-up ahead of Australia. They're a great warm-up ahead of the, you know, the main event, you know, the end of the summer. And for so long they've just had that, and they've responded to it for a while in the way that they've massively reduced the number of tests they've played over the last 5 years, because to them it doesn't make fiscal sense.
Yep.
And so it's unsurprising when having to find other avenues of income, they go to something like NFTs.
And I should say, for the record, by the way, that, you know, let's remember that Cricket Australia still have Bet365 plastered all over the boundaries, all over the sponge rope. It's not...
Well, the ICC have their own crypto.
The ICC have their own crypto. Yeah. I mean, you know...
Which was sponsoring West Indies up until about a couple of months ago, yeah. Until suddenly it wasn't there anymore.
Everyone's going to be doing it at some point. Yeah. You know what? No, let's not say that. Let's hope that everyone doesn't go down this path. But I suppose if Cricket New Zealand are serious, maybe they can be paid in NFTs for this relationship, and they can prove that they can be paid in revenue from
whatever
exactly.
It is. You know what?
Put your money where your mouth is.
If you really believe it, get paid in crypto.
Yeah, that's right. But yes, it's as they've described it, a landmark 5-year deal. As for Ian Botham, let's read out the tweet, shall we? My first ever NFT will be released on the whatever it's called,
Caduceus, I think.
Yeah, through Light Cycle. Bullshit. This is my part of the journey to bring cricket to the metaverse. Join the Cycle Discord and stay tuned. I mean.
Hashtag
honestly.
Lord Botham. Hashtag Lord NFT.
Botham. I mean, it's just too much, isn't it?
I think he was sending it to his
doctor. I was going to say, I like your old stuff better than your new stuff. Even if your old stuff did involve, you know.
So if you were to pick one cricketer to take you into the metaverse, how low, if you were to have a list of, you know, how low down would Botham be down that list? You know what? I would have Chapel above Botham.
Yeah.
I'd have Ian Chapel above Botham, but someone to take me on
my word, I'd have Ian Chapel any day. I'd take him over Ian Botham on any particular journey.
It's a real,
right.
It's a real kind of are we the baddies moment
from an
ashes attitude of approaching these kind of things.
Yeah, absolutely. Vish, before we take a breather, let's do a bit of nerd pledge. Now, Fred Cowan is our pledger this week, and his number is 458. Now, he says here, I was asked recently who my favourite Pakistani player was, and my answer is linked to 458. Originally, I looked at Ashraf Ali, unlikely as it is, but he's the only Pakistani test player to finish with an average of 45.8. He played 8 test matches in the 1980s. He had a brother who was prolific as well. I saw there are 458 high-resolution pictures on Getty of Rana Nawed Al Hassan.
How many of those pictures were taken after his hair transplant?
Oh, well, advanced hair. Yeah. We'll talk about that in a moment. The second clue that came through kindly from Fred was just an emoji of a crab.
Right, okay.
Which got me to Farwin Alarm quite quickly. Now, he did have a strike rate in a couple of one-day internationals against Australia a million years ago of 45.8. But I thought, surely that's not where Fred's going. I deduced that it must have something to do with the gap between the time in which his test career was on hold. So from the 24th of November 2009 until the 20th of August 2020. This is where it got interesting for me. That is 559 weeks and 2 days. And I thought to myself, oh, that feels like about, you know, that's about 10 years and 9 months, isn't it? And this is the most niche sort of indie cricket crossover of all time, but Art Brute stands for filler Emily Kane. In fact, I'll drop it in here.
I've not seen her in 10 years. 9 months, 3 weeks, 4 days, 6 hours, 13 minutes, 5 seconds.
So as you hear there, for Eddie Argos, who's the lead singer of Art Brute, it's been 10 years, 9 months, 3 weeks and change. since he's seen his old flame. Fawad Alam was out of Pakistan's test team for 10 years, 8 months and 3 weeks, exactly 1 month the difference. 1 month the difference. I couldn't believe this. I mean, for all the configurations of numbers. So that's my indie crossover with Fawad Alam. You've probably never heard that before. He was actually dropped last week, Fawad Alam.
I know.
Extraordinary
incredible.
Scenes. Osman Samiyuddin, well, your boss now, isn't he?
Yeah, yeah.
And a friend of ours, he put up a tweet. Obviously, he knows more about Pakistani cricket than anyone, about the injustice of that. But he has been recalled. I mean, bear in mind, he was dropped from the Pakistan team after missing out in Karachi and Lahore against Australia, and that's it, gone.
Yeah.
But he's been brought back for the second test match, which is playing out at the moment for Azhar Ali, who's been left out for the first time in 8 years. And he made a massive 100 against Australia in the first test at Rawalpindi back in March too. So one veteran replacing another. And that was after Pakistan's stunning chase last week where they hauled in about 340-odd in the final innings. I'm quite happy with my call in Pakistan saying Abdullah Shafiq's going to make 10,000 test runs, by the way.
Yeah, well, he looks proper, doesn't he?
Goodness me, he's good.
Yeah.
But anywhere between about cover and backward point, punching off the back foot, those wrists there, he's a very gifted special player, only 21, and he only played 2 first-class games before being picked for the test team, so they've got a live one there. Sri Lanka started well, though. They were 315 for 6 overnight, with Dinesh Chandimal continuing his bumper run. He made 80 of those. So that doesn't get us to what Fred Cowan's talking about,
say,
with 4-5-8.
I'm still thinking about this.
I do love that. That song takes me straight back to, well, you've been to Razzmatazz with me back in Melbourne years ago, Vish. I think of all my friends from there, not least Amelia, who had her second baby last week.
Oh,
love you, Amelia. Arabella.
Congratulations.
So she probably isn't listening. Her twin sister, Cressida, probably is. We love you as well. But yes, that song and that time frame is nearly bang on for Fawad Alam. So what you can do, Fred, is let us know what 4-5-8 actually means in relation to Fawad Alam. And we'll return to it on the Revisit Show, which this week, Storytime 99 is gigantic. So Jeff's not here with us this week because he's been a bit poorly over the weekend, and partly because preparing a Storytime program with about 30 numbers and about 30 obscure clues is not easy. So Jeff's allocating his time wisely in Manchester where he is at the moment, and we'll be back together tomorrow for a long interview. More on that later. All right, let's take a break on the final word. And after that, we're going to be talking about a couple of other series that are going on around the world, and we'll look forward to the Commonwealth Games.
Hi, my name's Kate Cross, and you're listening to The Final Word with Adam and Jeff.
As ever, The Final Word cricket broadcast is brought to you by the Advanced Hair Studio, the world leaders in hair restoration. Vish, 15% off if you go to Final Word Cricket, you go to advancedhairstudio.com/Final Word. All you need to do is put in your details and you are through to the semis without dropping a set. I caught up with our friend Steve Kinnane, the ABC's European correspondent. He's back from Ukraine at the moment. Saw him on the weekend, and he's got great hair.
He does.
Outstanding
actually.
Hair. Yeah. For a man of a certain age, which you won't like, I probably won't like me saying that. He's not 100, but he's not 30 either. His hair looks like he's still, you know, going out to Razzmatazz on a Saturday night.
You're right, he's not 100.
No, not even close. He was chuffed that we were talking about advanced hair and thought it was hilarious that Jeff and me with hair like us would be talking about them week to week. But so we are. You've got good lid too. I feel you, like me though, if you ever lost it, I mean really started losing it, you'd be pretty quick to get it sorted.
Definitely.
I mean, it's not as though I'm never going to go bald without trying to intervene first.
Yeah. You've always been a fighter, haven't you? You're a scrapper. That's what they say about you.
Yeah.
No, absolutely. I wouldn't leave the house if I lost my hair. So.
And of course, you're free to make that decision on your own account.
You are, yeah.
If you haven't got hair, you've made the call to go the other way. That's great.
But we're not saying if you don't have hair, stay inside. We're definitely not saying that.
advancedhairstudio.com/findaword for 15% off, and you can pally up with the world leaders in hair restoration, and we thank them for all their support of The Final Word throughout the summer of 2022. The England women have been playing a fairly unremarkable series against South Africa's women. South Africa, we talked about it last week, Jeff and I, that they look so good in the World Cup, and they've been rubbish over here. We had Laura Wolvart on the show last week. She made a half century in the first T20 international a day after we spoke to her, but they only made 111 for 9 in their 20 overs. Wolvart made 54 from 49, I think it was. It was probably a game that we reflected most upon for Sophia Dunkley going to the top of the list, boshing 59 from 39 balls in that brief chase. She hit 3 sixes in the power play. That recalibrated England batting lineup. The major piece of that was Dunkley going up, and it's working.
Yeah, yeah. It's certainly one of the big truisms about white ball cricket in general, but best players got to face the most balls, get them up the order. And especially at a time where the whole team is in a state of controlled flux, I'd say. You know, if you start at the back with the bowlers and the changes that we've had there. But also, someone like Dunkley she's always been, you know, when you talk to people who've known her for a while, they've always kind of penned her in as a three, really, haven't they? They've always had something about her that they thought was go through the gears, drop back down, and then go up again, and certainly had the fitness to do that. And obviously, it's a bit different with having Heather Knight there and someone who's going to take command of those three, four positions. But she's so malleable. And I suppose the problem with a player as malleable as she is sometimes you misuse them. Sometimes you might drop them a bit further down. But I feel like we're in a stage now where, certainly under Lisa Kightley, where because maybe she's come from the outside, she's a bit more, you know, she's got clearer eyes when she's looking at these players.
Yeah, and I like with Kightley how she's pretty upfront about why Beaumont's not in that Commonwealth game squad. I mean, that's a tough call.
It's a tough call.
But also, it's quite a logical call when you go through the, you know, where they fit in, and now Dunkley's moved to the top of the list. Beaumont found herself batting at six in the last T20 World Cup when there wasn't quite that depth, and they've brought that depth through the domestic structure, and now it's paying off in just 2 years.
Yeah. Even just out of habit, you would write an England team down and, you know, Beaumont on Winfield a couple of years ago, wasn't it? That was just that gut reaction, and then like maybe someone like Wyatt. But yeah, it was incredibly gutsy. It was when the press release came through, it was a bit like, they've made a mistake, haven't they? Like, can we, you know, we know the media manager. It was like, I think you've got a bit of a typo at the top.
I remember
that
happened once with when the Labor government in December 2007 were announcing the first cabinet, and a senior cabinet minister, Stephen Conroy, wasn't on the press release. He's like, hang on, what's going on here? He's about to be sworn in as I think he was leader in the Senate or deputy leader in the Senate, but not on the media release. It was kind of a bit of that, wasn't there? But yeah, it was a good call. I say a good call. In retrospect, who knows what we'll say in a couple of weeks after the Commonwealth Games have been run and won. But, you know, Izzy Wong making her third international debut in the space of 3 weeks, quite frugal in that first one day. And the other side of the spectrum, they've managed Brunt perfectly. Didn't play the test match. I've got a, you know, sneaking suspicion that she might be sort of, and this is hardly revelatory, but maybe the Commonwealth Games will be the end of the road for her. Maybe, on the other hand, with Brunt, far be it me to sort of presuppose anything with her. She's an independent thinker and she'll pull the pin when she's ready to pull the pin. But, you know, she took 4 for 14, her best figures in T20 cricket at what we're expecting will be the final stands of her career.
Yeah, look, obviously, I think there's... I wonder if she'll go once round on the, you know, on the T20 circuit just for the sake of it, I suppose. And also just it feels like at a time where things are aligning a lot better in that space. But yeah, I mean, it's a straight. I kind of hope it's not, just through the fact that we don't really know what the Commonwealth Games is going to be in terms of something that has a bit of longevity for the women's game.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, and that all starts on Friday, of course, as well. Australia, oh, I should say the second T20, South Africa performed better with Annika Bosch making 61 and Laura Goodall making 41. I mean, that's a good sign. That wasn't runs being made by the usual suspects, but England got there in 19 overs. Siva, as acting captain, Knight missed with a niggle, made 47. Wyatt, 39 from 24, so she's hitting her straps at the right time. They got a game into Bryony Smith batting at three. Didn't work, but again, they're sort of playing members of that group of 15 who'll gather in Birmingham later this week after their final T20, which is actually later today at Derbyshire. There was the women's tri-series ahead of the Commonwealth Games in Northern Ireland between Australia, Pakistan and Ireland. Unfortunately, that was a bit of a damp squib, literally. There were three games rained off. The last two were rained off over the weekend. Alana King took wickets every time she bowled, though. She was player of the series. Talia McGrath made 74 and landing 70, the only time that Australia got the chance to bat first. So Australia win the trophy, albeit only playing a couple of games. It's a quick and nasty comp, the comms. There are two groups of four. Australia play India in the opener on Friday, followed by Barbados representing the West Indies against Pakistan. All of the Barbados games will have international status as the West Indies, so it's not perfect, but I'm not losing any sleep over it. Needs must in a situation like this. Then on the Saturday, New Zealand start their campaign against the Proteas, and England play Sri Lanka in that prime time spot, presumably on BBC television on Saturday night, so that's great. Looking at the groups, you'd say that Australia and India are overwhelmingly likely to go through from Group A, with Barbados and Pakistan the other two teams there. And in Group B, you think it's probably New Zealand and England, with South Africa badly out of form at the moment and Sri Lanka the fourth team in that group. So time will tell, but the very fact that it's going to be front and centre, Vish, can't wait for it to start and see how it works. We've not had women's cricket in a competition like this before, and I suppose they'll be part of a much bigger apparatus and part of the team, and that'll be maybe even a once-in-a-generation opportunity for these players.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. It feels quite cool to be... We're in a quite a neat space when it comes to women's sport in general in the UK at the moment, what with the Women's Euros going on over here in England through to the semi-final. And, you know, you mentioned the BBC there. Like, I think a lot of people... You know, cricket's the kind of sport, when it's played in something like the Commonwealth Games, it very rarely gets a new viewer. And it's not in the same way that I would watch the gymnastics at the Olympics. But you do get... It's exactly the kind of competition that gets a lot of, you know, lapsed viewers, lapsed fans, you know, some floating voters. And I think the way those few of those teams are playing, maybe not quite South Africa at the moment, but you consider the way that India and Australia and England and what we know New Zealand can do, there is because it's such a small, condensed tournament, it feels like the quality will be that little bit higher in the kind of condensed space that it occupies.
Yeah, that's right. I think... As you do, that this might give the game a chance with something of a new audience, and good luck to it. And also, it'll hopefully provide evidence of why it could work in the Olympic Games. But that's a bit of a watch this space as well. The last thing we'll talk about today. Oh, by the way, thanks everybody who watched the Laura Wolver interview either on YouTube or listened on the podcast last week. She was an absolute gem. We probably only appreciated how good she was when we listened back to the interview. Surely she's the future captain of that team. She's a star.
That interview was incredible because it just reinforced a few things, because we always talk about how she could have done many, many different things.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, when she was here for the 2017 World Cup, she was on her way to medical school, something like
that's
that.
That's right.
She can sing, she can dance, and she can bat. And I mean, that's future captaincy material right there.
Yeah, yeah. We do have another major interview coming up on the feed this week. I won't tell you who it is, but I will say this. It'll be the person on the final word. No one has ever scored more runs than this person coming on the final word. No one will have ever scored more professional runs. Yeah, I'm fairly certain that's right, than the guest we have tomorrow, which will come out in a couple of days. The last topic, we're only going to touch on it briefly because Jeff's going to Scotland as well, so he'll be able to get more information on the report that was released over the weekend. It's actually released today, but it was leaked on Saturday, about institutional racism, which is what it was called in Scottish cricket. The board resigned as one on Sunday. We are truly sorry and we have apologised publicly to everyone who's experienced racism or any other form of discrimination in cricket in Scotland, they said as they all collectively pulled the pin. Sports Scotland commissioned the report, and it was prepared by an organisation called Plan for Sport, who are a diversity specialist group. Over 200 people gave evidence. It was brought upon after Majid Haq made accusations last year around the Azeem Rafiq story. He played 200 times for Scotland up until the 2015 World Cup. His allegation is that he was moved on from Scottish cricket on the basis of race. So that's been borne out in the report, although I must say I've not read it yet. We will read it. We will treat this properly. But just marking a place. And, you know, Vish, you've spent lots of time in Scotland. You spent your university years there.
Yeah, yeah. It was quite shocking, actually, when it came out that the whole board resigned over the weekend. I think the fact that it was bubbling over the last year was quite... I think if you look at how it's played out, Cricket Scotland took the allegations very seriously immediately. And perhaps the fact that it was aligned with what Yorkshire were undergoing, and the fact that Yorkshire went first and completely botched it, which probably helped in terms of showing other organisations how they shouldn't behave in that situation. I think the thing that, I suppose to work backwards from here, the thing that I was a little bit worried about with the board resigning was that, you know, I've just come from Headingley. Lord Kamlesh Patel did the rounds in the press box, and Yorkshire is still struggling to bring in not so much the right people, but the amount of people they need, not just at boardroom level, but in terms of dealing with media, that kind of media, and also just putting people in place to rebuild the club in the way that they need to. And I mean that in a sense of, because they've lost so many people.
Sacked them all.
Yeah, in key positions. And, you know, there's that
some of whom have taken it, who are contesting the dismissal.
Yeah, yeah. So that's a tribunal in October later this year. But primarily they... What happens in this situation is there is a vacuum that doesn't really get filled, or certainly it gets filled with people who are focused one way, or people who don't necessarily have the expertise to work at a board, whether it's at international or county level. And the knock-on effect that I've seen is that, you know, the playing group at Yorkshire, they're a bit disillusioned, not necessarily with the movement of travel for the county itself, but more the fact that the actual cricket playing part becomes a bit secondary. And now that this is a knock-on effect after a knock-on effect of how things have been going at the county. But primarily they need to get people in there as soon as possible to even just react to what the report is going to say. Because it's not so much, as much as it is about holding people to account, the reason these things are commissioned is to say, right, where do we go from here? And it's important to get those people in straight away. And now to speak on, you know, Kazim Sheikh and Majid Tak, as you mentioned, who are the people who've certainly put their faces to these allegations. Because the thing I think we should underline, as we should always with the Yorkshire thing, that often gets discarded because we have a name in Azim Rafiq and a face in that Azim Rafiq who's talked about it, is that this is not down to two players. There is a body of, a body has gone through and spoken to a number of players.
Over 200 people have been interviewed for this.
Many people who don't want to be on the record, many people who don't want their names to it, who have gone and had conversations either over the phone or in person and talked about it, their experiences of Scottish cricket. And I think it's also important to say that this isn't just a Scottish problem in the way that it's not just a Yorkshire problem or an Essex problem. So it'll be interesting to see how, given the ECB's investigation into Yorkshire has gone on for so long, it'll be interesting to see what we garner from this report and indeed how the whole process is approached. Because they've seen, you know, neighbours south of Hadrian's Wall go about it in one way, and it's not been a quick way, and to be honest, so far it hasn't been an effective or a smart way. But they have an opportunity here to come out the other side, you know, in quite a strong position.
Yeah, I think that's right. So with respect to the how it was pulled together, I mean, they've got a crisis comms firm working for Cricket Scotland right now, which gives a sense of, and they've got no board, right? So it's going to be a rugged time for them. But yeah, and the point you made around Yorkshire as well, I mean, they have got a long way to go, but I think they've garnered a lot of goodwill for in the last little while, I mean, by throwing the doors open, Lord Patel doing lots of media, acknowledging where there's divisions in the club. I think one of the most telling points in his interview on Test Match Special, probably around the Leeds Test it would have been, is when he said there'll be some Yorkshire members who never accept what happened as racist. And the contrast to this is that term institutional racism, that's quite a loaded term in the broader discourse at the moment. Like for them to say that, they will know it'll be a lightning rod, and that's going to presumably be a catalyst for hopefully real change into the future once we've seen the warts and all report which has been written, but also making people pay attention. Because I think that, as Lord Patel said, there'll be some people who won't, and you need to use forceful language for it to cut through sometimes.
Yeah, that's absolutely spot on. It's not, because the issue has been that over generations, certainly in my lifetime, elements of it have been sugar-coated, certainly in the way that it's reported and the language used, and therefore people think, okay, maybe it's not that big a deal.
Yeah.
And I think the other thing to say, because it's lost in the term institutional racism on people who see it as an outright attack on the institution that they love or that they work for, is that it isn't just pointing at someone and calling them a slur. It's having that mindset of, you know, one of the phrases that was used here, which is also a phrase that came up in the Yorkshire investigation, was too many of you lot. Like this idea that there is, you know, that there's something othering off them. About someone, othering them, exactly that, yeah. And even just doing it covertly without actually, you know, being nice to their face and being like, well, yeah, actually, you're not going to be in our team because we think you're a little bit different, or we just think the way you might not go for a drink with the rest of the team, that's a little bit awkward. We want a group of players who, like, 11 on the field, 11 in the bar, that kind of thing. And so a lot of it is behavioural as well, and just like changing attitudes. And when people talk about education, they don't mean you can't call him that. They mean here's where you need to take another step to make him feel a bit more included because he doesn't do this or he doesn't do that. Or his family situation is this, and his
that's right. It's sort of almost like here's how you need to understand, but that by virtue of the world you've grown up in, you are going to be wired a certain way. It's not about making it about the individuals per se. It's about making them understand it's part of a broad culture. Anyway, quite heavy stuff to finish the show, Vish. We will talk more about Scotland in weeks to come. As I say, I think Jeff's intention is to get up there while he's in the UK. Right, that's it, I think. Vish, thanks for being a wonderful co-host as ever. Final Word is brought to you by the Advanced Test Studio. Jump on advancedteststudio.com/finalword for your 15% discount on the full service, the full works. Get your locks looked at. We're going to have that big bumper interview dropping into the feed. Let's call it part two of the weekly show. We didn't want to do it all in one. Otherwise, it would be a It's going to be a 90-minute interview by the sounds of things, so we didn't want it to be a 2.5-hour show this week. And, of course, we'll be back with story time on the weekend as well. Thanks for listening. Thanks for watching. Thanks to the team at Bad Producer Productions, especially Dave Collins, who edit us and make us look pretty. James Hurley, who does all the video. If you have not yet been to our Instagram and Facebook since we started using it, our Twitter account as well, that was moribund for 3 years. We've got the clips going out there, so there'll be a nice clip of Vish. If you're hearing it on the podcast and you're like, I wonder what that Andrew Strauss sounding character looks like in real life, you can take a look at the clip we'll pull out of him. All right, that's it. This has been The Final Word. Thanks for listening. Thanks for watching. We'll do it all again later in the week. Bye-bye. I had to go.